This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Take this woman as your lawful wedded wife.
Ooh, yeah!
Oh, no.
Place the ring on her finger and repeat after me. With this ring.
With this ring.
I thee wed.
I thee wed.
Hello, Place to Be Nation, and welcome to episode 2 of With This Ring. I am your one of your hosts, Ryan Everett, along with my lovely wife.
Hello, I'm Cindy Everett.
Yes, and we're here to start going down the list of the GWWE greatest matches ever. I've been watching wrestling since 1990. Cindy?
I've been watching wrestling since I met you, so yep. 2010.
And very on the peripheral.
Right, very casual. Yes. So I'm bringing the outsider's uninformed perspective.
Well, because the one thing that this podcast group was really missing is a 33-year-old white male's perspective on wrestling from the 80s and 90s, and that's what I hope to give and include it with, you know, what is most prevalent is, you know, people who haven't watched wrestling at all talking about it. That's the overlaying theme of this website, but I wanted to give an outsider view from what is usually viewed. So last week we focused on tag team matches, and this week we changed it up and looked at bloodbaths. And Cindy, going into it, how did you feel about the bloodbaths?
Not really looking forward to it. I'm not a big blood person. I'm an accountant by day, so it's about as far from the medical practice as you can be. I don't like blood. I don't like seeing it. I don't like giving it. it was not
a
really
a bit squeamish.
A little squeamish, but honestly, it wasn't as bad, because I think when I think of blood matches, I think of like the iconic Steve Austin shot where he's like literally covered almost like Carrie style.
Right.
And none of the matches that we watched were really quite that level.
Don't worry, we'll get to that.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, so it's actually coming up rather quickly. But yeah, so
it was nothing. Yeah, it was not as bad as I thought it was going to
be. Okay, that's good.
Yeah. One the Triple H match was a little gratuitous.
But yeah.
Other than that, It was manageable.
Okay, yeah. So we went through 5 matches, and a nice little new feature we have today is Cindy will add fun facts for each arena.
Well, I was able to find them. So yes. Yeah, I mean, so I'm an accountant by day, but on the weekends I am an architecture tour guide.
Right.
So I'm interested in the built environment. Not obviously something that translates to a podcast medium very easily, but
we'll do what we can.
Yeah, where I could find interesting things, I would like to throw those in.
Yeah. So our first match we did, we went to June 16th, 1984, and it was Sergeant Slaughter versus the Iron Sheik in a boot camp match. And for all of these matches, they all have their special little names to them, but all of them were basically no disqualification matches, anything goes.
Right.
Well, one was a steel cage match, but we'll get to that. But for the most part, they're all just regular matches where anything goes, but the pinfall is in the ring.
Right.
So this was a boot camp match, and it was basically anything goes. Sergeant Slaughter, because he was a former drill instructor.
Right.
That was his type of match that he would want against the Iron Sheik. And for years, he had been actually the heel.
Sergeant Slaughter?
Yeah. Really? Well, he had been a heel.
Okay.
He had been like just the dick military drill instructor guy. And he really didn't change the character that much. It was just all of a sudden Hulk Hogan came in, beat the Iron Sheik for the world.
He was more America than Sergeant Slaughter.
Well, he kind of took that role as being Mr. America. But then at the same time, so the Iron Sheik was kind of just a monthly challenger for the champ at the time, Bob Backlund.
Okay.
But when Vince McMahon was able to get Hulk Hogan, he was like, that's the guy who I want to build the company around. So whoever's facing Bob Backlund this month at Madison Square Garden is winning the title.
Oh, okay.
So it just happened to be the Iron Sheik. So the Iron Sheik won the title, held it for 3 weeks, lost it to Hulk Hogan.
Just a stepping stone to get it to Hulk Hogan.
He was a transit. Why
couldn't Bob Backlund just give it directly to Hogan?
Because you wouldn't have a babyface lose it to a babyface. Okay. Especially Hulk Hogan, he had been in WWF before, but as a heel. So if he was going to come in and beat the guy who had been the babyface champion for 6 years, it would have been hard to really make him...
The momentum.
They needed someone he hated, and an Iranian in the early 1980s was pretty easy to hate. So, but then after that, so what they did in the early days of the Vince McMahon takeover of wrestling.
When did Vince McMahon take over the company?
He got it, well, he bought it from his dad in like mid-1983.
Oh, okay.
And then like he was kind of slowly plotting this, because he wanted, back then it was everything was regional.
Right.
And he wanted to go national and eventually international. And soon he'll be
worked out global.
Well, soon he'll be sending it to the moon and whatnot.
The
Mars
colony will have.
Yeah, WrestleMania 50 on Mars. So he needed someone. Bob Backlund was not a guy that would work in Los Angeles and
Dallas. Okay, so they needed someone like the everyman.
Even more than that. Because Bob Backlund kind of was like the blue-collar guy, but they needed a superhero, which was Hulk Hogan. But also what he wanted to do, he didn't want to do one or two shows a night. He wanted to do at least two or three shows a night. So you'd have an A show and a B show. So your A show is going to be Hulk Hogan.
Always.
And then your B show, you need a secondary face to be that. So now you have the Iron Sheik as one of your main heels, because you could always claim he's a former world champ. So then you take the Dick military instructor that you have, Sergeant Slaughter, you make him the face of the B cards.
Got it.
And like Sergeant Slaughter at the time was very big. He was on G.I. Joe.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever... I was thinking about that. I don't think... And I've never paid attention to a match with Sergeant Slaughter or the Iron Sheik. I think this is the first match I've seen with them. Like either of them.
Right, yeah. So they made Sergeant Slaughter... He was basically for a while the number two babyface in the company. And then eventually he got in a fight with Vince McMahon over licensing rights, because WWE had the big rubber guys that are in the garage.
Oh, yeah.
So that the LGN figures.
Do you want to explain what they're talking about?
Well, I think most people will. Most people listening to this will understand that the LGN figures.
In the garage.
In my garage, I have quite a collection of wrestling figures. And so that's what the WWF, that's who made their characters back in the day, back in the mid-80s. And then Hasbro, who ended up making WWF figures, but at the time their biggest thing was G.I. Joe characters.
Okay.
And they made a G.I. Joe character of Sergeant Slaughter. And Vince McMahon said, like, I should be getting a percentage
some money for that.
And Sergeant Slaughter disagreed. And eventually they cut cords with each other for a while. He'll come back, though, and he'll actually come back to our project as well.
Oh, okay.
So we have that to look forward to. So on to the actual match, though. They had a match the month before at Madison Square Garden. It was the May show, because each month they had a show at Madison Square Garden. And the May show ended, I think it was like a 10-minute double disqualification. Iron Sheik took off his boot.
Mm.
And his boot, because it had the horn on it, could somehow be loaded.
Right.
And he,
you're telling me this,
he brutalized Sergeant Slaughter with it, where Sergeant Slaughter was a bloody mess. So then they decided they'll have the rematch the next month, and it will be a boot camp match.
Okay.
So.
That's a little bit of context. Even knowing that, though, I felt the boot thing was a little gimmicky. I guess, though, so, they're at least trying to come up with something.
Yeah, they're doing their best. So overall, the match itself, what did you feel like? How did you...
Let's see, my notes, I said very unsanitary.
Yes. Because this was back in the day, there were no protective mats around the ring.
Oh, right, it was...
So they're just bleeding, and most of the, I think, for sure, Sergeant Slaughter bleeds when he's thrown into the post on the outside, so...
Right,
cutting himself on the dirty ground of Madison Square Garden. I forgot exactly when the Sheik...
It was relatively early on, too.
I think it was a They called it Sergeant Slaughter's clothesline the Slaughter Cannon.
That's what it was.
So I think that was what did him in. So at least that was in the ring.
I remember being entertained but not blown away by it.
I could see that. It was 16 minutes and 2 seconds. So it was one of the shorter matches that we saw.
Yeah, it didn't feel that short, though.
There were parts of it that I think kind of dragged, like Sergeant Slaughter would have his riding crop, use that as a weapon for a little bit, and then Iron Sheik would get it, and then Sergeant Slaughter would put on his helmet, do a few headbutts, and then Iron Sheik would get a chair. And
yeah, a lot of props in these matches. All the matches we watched had a fair amount of props.
Yes, I would agree with that, yeah. So overall, feelings about the match? High, low?
I think it's going to be probably near the middle.
Okay, yeah.
Middle ground for me.
Yeah, it's kind of weird when you're looking at the whole history of the WWF. Like, this is kind of one of the earliest matches that people will be, like, heaping praise on and saying it's one of the best.
Oh, okay.
Like, of that time, at least. Because before the 70s and early 80s was different than... This is, like, kind of the start of the change.
Of the Vince era?
Yes. This is probably the best match of the early Vince era.
Okay.
If you would say that's, like, mid-83 till WrestleMania 1, which is March of 85.
Okay. And so how do they cut themselves exactly? Because it's not... I mean, they make it look like it's...
Well, they usually... If you have a good cameraman, they turn away from it.
Oh, okay.
Because that's always a big thing. You don't want to be caught on camera doing it because it kind of exposes the business. But the main thing they do is they take a razor, like just a regular razor that you would use to shave, usually break it in half.
Okay.
And then most guys would just wrap it in their wrist tape.
Oh.
And then at the predisposed time in the match where they were needed to.
Predetermined?
They would take it out and just go across their face.
Ugh. See, that gives me the... That.
Yeah. And some guys would do it different. Like, I think Ric Flair always talked about how he somehow would keep it in his mouth.
That seems really unsafe.
Yeah, I'm surprised that, like, Ric Flair is known as the greatest wrestler of all time and didn't end up dying in a match in 1982 when he swallowed a razor blade.
Oh, God. See that?
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, how deep are they cutting it, too? Because I guess the skin
on your forehead's would usually be pretty superficial.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, a lot of guys, like, not so much in WWF, but in the NWA, which was eventually WCW. Like, Dusty Rhodes, like, if you see, like, a late, like, when he was just a talking head on DVDs, you see, like, all the scar tissue on his head. Because he would just do it night after night after night. Where I don't think you'd even get state. You'd probably like just like put a Band-Aid on, and then you'd have like 5 cage matches in a row.
Yeah.
So then the next night you didn't even have to use a blade.
You
would just like scratch yourself basically, and it would cut open. Yeah.
When did they start? Was this always a part of wrestling, or was it
pretty much? I mean, like the 60s. I think they always did it. Like the 60s is kind of when they became in fashion, I think, because I don't know. Well, because in the 50s, wrestling was big on national TV, on the Dumont Network from Chicago. So I don't know, like, what I have to. I have a feeling, though, that back then, like, they'd have national, like, the FCC or whatever.
Oh, okay.
That version of it was at the time would frown people bleeding.
Right.
So I think it was kind of like, after that kind of fell out of fashion in the 60s is when it became more regionalized. And you would just have it on your local stations.
Channel,
I have a feeling that's when it kind of picked up. And it's always was bigger in the South. Texas and the Southern territories were always bigger into bleeding for whatever reason.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure why exactly, but that's always what it's seemed like. So, yeah. So, this match, it ends with Sergeant Slaughter using the boot. It uses the Iron Sheik's own boot, which, as we pointed out, the Sheik loaded the boot, which somehow makes it much more deadlier.
Loaded it with what, exactly?
Well, they're not sure. You know, he's from Iran. Who knows what
magic
he did?
The genie?
Well, he usually kicked it to somehow, like, I think they were always saying that, like, he kicked the weight into it to make it heavier somehow.
It's a boot.
Yeah.
It's already heavy.
Well, also in wrestling, always, no matter what, a boot, if you take it off and swing it at a guy, it's much more deadly than kicking a guy with that same boot with your foot attached to it.
Which makes no sense.
Of course it doesn't. No, but it's wrestling. You have to accept.
It's more impactful, though, right, to take it off.
I guess. I mean, it's one of those things when you're watching wrestling, you just have to accept.
Right. There's a certain degree of that in all of this.
And speaking of things you just have to accept, we'll move on to...
Oh, wait, you have to say where it's going to rank in your...
Oh, top. Okay, yeah. So I would give this... This would be a 9 for me out of 10.
Okay.
So 9 out of 10. So think of it like that. And okay. It's probably going to be top 30, top...
Really?
Maybe 25, because I think it's one of those matches that it's going to get a bump because of its historical
context.
Like, let's say on Raw this week, which there probably won't be, but there was a 9-star match, or a 9 out of 10 match. The boot camp match, though, would be much more memorable than anything I think they'd have nowadays.
Really?
For the most part, unless it's like a main event of a pay-per-view. I don't see anything... really competing, because it is like a match that is known
well within a certain
group of people, but I mean, right? It's like I said, there's not that many matches that people that start, because really this was just before the boom of the 80s started.
I see.
That was kind of
the early years,
late 84 into 85, that like the WrestleMania boom happened with Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper and everyone getting involved. So this was like, and this was involved, this was on like the early Coliseum videos. So it was, it still got play. Even though like after a certain point, Sergeant Slaughter was persona non grata in the WWF, they still kind of always highlighted this match.
I gotcha.
Like in 1990, when I was going to Farmore and renting videos, this was one of the first matches I saw.
Okay.
So it was always a big... It's a good match, and I think it has enough historical significance to it, which is something that comes into play with these matches.
Okay. Well, they couldn't do that nowadays, right? Because they can't bleed anymore intentionally.
True. That's also... Yeah, that's a big part. That's why...
When did that ban go into effect, that rule?
Well, So, there's a reason we don't have anything from 86 till 2000. Because it kind of was like 87 to 97. And then the blood was back in. And then it was, I think 2008 is when they became TV PG.
Oh, okay. That's why they
and
had
that's
to
like
it.
The main reason. Like, there's been blood a couple of times between them, but it's always been, A, it's been like Undertaker, Brock Lesnar, John Cena, guys who can do it. Or it's been an accident.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
There's the one NXT match where it was Samoa Joe and Finn Balor.
Oh, that's the one we were at. Well, there's one that we were at where someone, I thought that was John Cena. We were at a match where someone started bleeding.
We were Brock Lesnar, Randy Orton.
That's right.
And that was kind of like, that was weird because that was like the planned finish of the match where it was just like Brock Lesnar's going to beat Randy Orton so that he bleeds his own blood. Like, usually it's plan to be the finish of the match, or it's like an accident and the refs wear the gloves the whole time when they are bleeding now.
Right.
So it is much more sanitary and real sports like. And it's not, it's like a guy bleeding from the nose or like right above the eyebrow. It's not right across the forehead.
Because
if you are bleeding straight across the forehead, you did not just receive that from a punch, obviously.
Well, like you said, it's certain you have to
suspend your disbelief. Suspension of disbelief is very necessary for a wrestling fan.
Okay.
Madison Square Garden?
Well,
fun fact one, because we will...
Well, the fun facts are somewhat interrelated, but this one, I think I mentioned this to you, Madison Square Garden is the last NBA/NHL arena that is not named after a corporate sponsor.
Oh, okay. Good.
So,
yeah.
All the other ones have...
Have sold out.
Yeah, sold their souls to the man, except for Madison Square Garden.
And it's funny, because Madison Square Garden is... They had a Raw and SmackDown there a few weeks ago, like about a month ago now, but the reason they hadn't held it, and I think that was the first time in 10 years, was because the rights to hold it there, the TV rights are so expensive. That's why they've basically moved to the Barclays Center when they're in New York.
They're in Brooklyn.
Because it's not owned, well, it's not a sponsor.
But its name is so iconic.
Right, yeah.
It doesn't need
it's owned by James Dolan, the owner of the Knicks, and he's like a huge dick, basically, who anything that is in Madison Square Garden, he charges like four times what it would be to be held anywhere else. And Jay-Z, meanwhile, has the Barclays Center. He's like, hey, come here.
Yeah.
Come here, get the name out.
I can make money off of you.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I like the Barclays Center.
Yeah, I thought that's a good arena. It's set up for concerts and wrestling shows, and it's not set up for hockey though, because
the
New York Islanders tried to move there, and I think they played like 2.5 seasons there, and they moved.
Like, nope.
They were like, "This isn't good at all for hockey."
Yeah.
All right, and speaking of gardens, we're going to move down to the Boston Garden.
That's right.
A February 8th, 1986, and this is quite the show. The main event we'll get to, but before that, earlier in the show, we had a rare house show title change as Tito Santana lost the Intercontinental title to, who would you think?
In 1986?
Yes.
Tito Santana?
Tito Santana lost to the person with the most figures in the garage.
Oh, Randy Savage.
Yes, yes. Macho Man Randy Savage won his first title that night.
That same night.
That same show.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Before or after?
Before, because the match we saw was the main event.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because back in that time, like now the cage just drops.
Okay.
You know, back then they had to set up the cage. So they would have like a 20-minute, the intermission usually was in the middle of the show, but for cage, if it was a cage match, the intermission was right before the
end. So they
had
to like assemble it piece by piece?
Well, it would be like, there were probably about 8 pieces, like 2 panels per side of the ring.
Right.
Almost.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
That's usually how it worked. It changed eventually when they went to the big blue bars. I don't know.
Maybe I can't picture the blue bar. Yeah. Yeah, the big blue bars, but
yeah, but that was kind of how it's
picturing them like screwing together
the chicken wire cages.
Chicken wire cage, yes. Yeah.
So this match was Bruno Sammartino versus Roddy Piper. Roddy Piper, as if he needed another reason to prove to myself that he is the man, comes out wearing a Chicago Bears t-shirt and hangs up posters of Jim McMahon and No Dumb Cook. He might be a rookie, but he's No Dumb Cookie, William the Refrigerator Perry. And this was just less than 2 weeks after Super Bowl.
I thought that was funny. I thought that was a nice touch.
I mean, there's always easy heel heat to make going after the local sports team, and that
especially
is
especially in Boston.
Yeah, especially in Boston, and especially like that way.
Right.
Like it's so fresh in everyone's mind. Even though really I don't think anyone in Boston cared about the Patriots until like 2001.
True.
But let's not get into
that. Yeah, that's a whole different podcast.
Get into people who aren't really Patriots fans on the Place to Be Nation where most of them are in New England.
That's true.
But nevertheless, notwithstanding. So Roddy Piper comes out with his bagpipes. He hangs up his posters.
Chicago.
And then out comes Bruno Sammartino. He's just an old Italian man jogging to the ring. No music. What did you think of him?
I think that was the first one, same thing, first time I'd seen a match of him. I mean, I thought he was in good shape for like an older guy.
Yeah, he was, I think
really
he was
physical. And
he was about 38 at the time, I think, because he was born in 48, I think. Let me make sure on that.
You don't know off the top of your head?
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, he died last year, and I think he was 80? No, that one. Yeah, that would make sense. Oh, no. Oh, goodness. He was born in 1935.
You were a little off.
Yeah, so he was 53.
That makes more sense.
Yeah.
That's what I thought you said when we watched it.
Yeah, but, I mean, 53 looked pretty good.
He did, yeah. He wasn't really, really, he was just wasn't really taking any of his shit. You know, he just wanted to get in and start right
away. Yeah, and he had like the super super emphasized Italian dad bod.
Exactly, dad bod, all the body hair.
Yeah, he's got the body hair. He's got like a little paunch, but you could tell he's muscular. He was muscular at least.
Right.
And and
that former athlete.
Would you be surprised if I told you until Hulk Hogan, like 2 years earlier, was the biggest star in WWF of all time?
Really?
Yes.
He started pretty early, so he had a pretty long reign.
So from 1963 to 1971, he was the champ. So that's 8 years.
Yeah, that's a long
And then...
time. 19... He's like the New England Patriots of the early wrestling.
He really is. And then he wanted some time off. So Vince McMahon Sr., this is his dad, took the belt off him and gave it to Pedro Morales. So now the Italians wouldn't come to the shows, but you'd have the Puerto Ricans coming to the shows every month.
Yeah, he always made sure his audience had someone.
And then... So Pedro Morales held it for about 2.5 years, and then he lost it to a guy named Stan Stasiak, who lost it 10 days later, back to Bruno Sammartino, and Bruno held it for another 4 years.
Oh, wow.
So he basically was champ from 1963 to 1978, he was champion for basically 13 years.
Wow.
So he was
whenever he wanted it, he would
Yeah, get whenever it, he was ready to go, and, I mean, there was... In 1976, he broke his neck. Ooh. And...
Wait, and he was the champ for 2 more years after that?
Oh, yeah. He took, like, 3 weeks off.
Oh, that doesn't sound very
safe. No, it's not safe at all, but and they had a big show coming up at Shea Stadium, and it was part of the... Muhammad Ali fought a Japanese wrestler, so they were simulcasting that. So people would go to that, but they needed a match to draw people locally. And it was Bruno Sammartino faces Stan Hansen, the guy who broke his neck.
No, that's nice.
Of course. Well,
the show must go on, I guess.
Yes.
And he died last year.
Yeah, he died last
that's
year.
That's impressive.
April 2018. Yeah, and he was a guy who, from 87 until 2013, he had nothing to do with them.
I was going to say, he was off the scene
He was even like in the early 90s, WWF had some legal troubles with the steroid issue, and there were ring boys were saying that they were sexually assaulted at shows, and most of that actually kind of turned out to be pretty fake.
Like overblown.
Overblown, but anytime there was like a Donahue about this or anything, or Larry King, Bruno Sammartino would show up just to like bash the WWF.
What? What was the falling out? What happened?
They had a big falling out. The main thing happened? Well, for one thing, his son tried wrestling and sucked. And he kind of always blamed the WWF for not sticking with him. And also, like, he was a big anti-drug guy.
Okay. And that's probably why he lived so long.
Yeah. And, I mean, like, you know, he was the guy for so long, and Hulk Hogan then becomes a bigger star than he ever was. And Hulk Hogan, obviously, has done a few drugs, believe it or not.
A couple. I believe it. I'm not going to dispute that.
So going into this match, though, let's focus in.
Right, yeah.
I mean, there's been plenty of talk about Bruno Sammartino and where he ranks. But this match, so this is another example of, like, I mean, I don't think this is really a B show, because you have the Intercontinental title changing hands, and then you have Bruno Sammartino on the card. This was another way, though, that Vince McMahon would do it if Hulk Hogan needed a weekend off.
Okay, yeah.
You'd bring in Bruno Sammartino, you'd have all the other titles on the show, and that's going to sell out the Boston Garden, which is probably at the time their second biggest
area. And the Boston Garden was originally called the Boston Madison Square Garden.
Oh.
Because...
That name recognition?
Yeah, well, the boxer who developed Madison Square Garden in the 1920s, his vision was to build 7 different Madison Square Gardens around the country.
Oh, wow.
But he only got the Boston and the New York ones built.
Do we know where the other Madison Square Gardens were?
I didn't say. I was curious where they were supposed to be located. But I'm guessing East Coast, 1925. So.
Probably East Coast. Maybe Chicago would be Chicago, about as far west as you're willing to go.
But I can't imagine like a Chicago Madison Square Garden.
So
it doesn't really roll off the tongue.
No, it doesn't. Even Boston Madison Square Garden.
Exactly.
Too many words.
Right.
So the actual match itself starts, and Bruno Sammartino comes in and just beats the ever-living shit out of Roddy Piper.
Right.
He takes the posters and shoves them down his throat.
Yes. That was funny.
Yeah, I thought that was entertaining. It was a good, And it's a quick match, because, again, one of your guys is 53 years old.
Right.
You're not going to have him go too long. It goes eight minutes.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, I
said it was very physical. It took me a while. You'd explain to me a couple of times the whole point of
the cage match and how it works. Yeah, well, because WWF cage matches were different, because a lot of like the NWA title or cage matches were you still just pin or submission in the cage. But WWF did it different, where it was sometimes they'd have pin or submission in the cage, but mostly it was escape the cage.
Okay.
Yeah. But the thing with it would be, it wouldn't be just like try to, you know, get your opponent in the ropes and escape. It was like you beat your opponent so badly couldn't do anything and you could just walk out the door. Like, nowadays they climb the cage a lot just for the high spots there. But back then it would be like Bruno Sammartino beat the shit out of George Animal Steel and was able to walk out the door.
I can see how that's the theory, but it doesn't really work that way in practice.
Right, yeah. And especially now, you know, if you have anything with height, people are expecting a big spot off of it. Whereas back then it was just
there, right?
Back then it was just an implement of destruction. And that's kind of what it was in this match. I mean, Roddy Piper eventually gets a couple of moves, but really it's
they don't really
a Bruno ass kicking.
Yeah, you're right. They don't utilize the cage.
Yeah, the cage is just really to throw people into in this match.
Right, and hang posters up on.
Yes, and hang posters up.
Obviously.
Yes. So this is one where it's kind of, this was another one where this one I went 8.5 out of 10. So this will be right around top 50, maybe a little lower, like 50 to 60-ish range. Because I think it's great to see Bruno Sammartino like still having matches like this at his age.
That's true.
And like there's a lot of Bruno on the network, but some of the 70s matches just don't translate. And I think for a guy so important to the company, you should have him represented in some way.
Right.
And even this, like, later toward in his career, he was still able to do this, show something. And Roddy Piper in 1986 is just probably one of the top five characters of all time.
Yeah, it was very entertaining.
Yes, I agree.
Now, should we talk about the blood in the matches? Because that's the
end of the week. I guess we could. Yeah, so this one, I'm pretty sure it was just Piper.
Yeah,
I don't
just
think
Roddy Piper. It was kind of near the end, if I remember.
Yeah, it was
more of an afterthought.
It was kind of just Bruno just kept throwing him from side to side into the cage, and eventually he came up bloody. But it wasn't, it was bloody, but it wasn't like ridiculous, I think.
Right.
It wasn't overkill in this match. The previous match kind of,
it was a little
when they had both of them bleeding all over each other, it was a bit much.
Right, yeah, it seemed like they're other people's blood like smeared on their bodies.
Yeah,
like,
back then, you know, you didn't know about stuff.
I think they knew enough, especially there were, like, their AIDS crisis going on in the 80s.
Yeah, but back then it was just gay guys got AIDS.
Oh,
no wrestlers were ever gay.
Right. They weren't worried about AIDS?
No, I guess not.
Ooh.
I mean, I think it was kind of like I think back then it was, like, in the middle 80s, it was literally,
that's true. They didn't realize
it. It wasn't until Ryan White was at the kid. Yeah. And that was like 87, 88, I think.
Good point.
And so, I mean, for one thing, no one's going to look at Bruno Sammartino and say he has AIDS. I mean, he's like the manliest man,
the man
around. Oh, and I mean, and Roddy Piper, yeah, he was in the drugs and stuff. But
so he could have gotten AIDS from the drugs.
Well, I think he just, all his drugs went up his nose. I don't think he had to
inject anything. Well, there's that at least.
Yes, at least he was
not like using any dirty needles.
He was using drugs that wouldn't harm anyone else except when he was driving and anything else.
We're not going to go down that path there.
Yeah,
but
it's a slippery slope.
Yeah. No, I said really physical.
Yep.
Oh, Roddy Piper had his ass hanging out.
There's a little bit of that.
Another two, and that was...
Yeah, for all the ladies in the Boston Garden that night.
The lady, maybe?
Yeah, the two or three ladies that were there.
That went... It wasn't very titillating, I guess.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean...
Just more when I go, like, hike them up.
Right.
But no, overall, I thought that was entertaining. It was a good one.
Good. All right.
I'm going to rank that ahead of the Sergeant Slaughter one.
Okay, good. Yeah, we'll get to the
rankings
later.
But I'm just kind of thinking as I go, that's going to be ahead.
Of course, we want to remind you that we have plenty of great content on both podcast feeds here at the Place to Be Nation. The Place to Be Nation pop feed includes the Hard Traveling Fanboys, the longest running weekly episodic comic podcast in all of the Place to Be Nation, featuring Greg Phillips and Nick Duke, the DC For You, an in-depth look at the world of DC Comics with Russell Sellers and Todd Weber,
Laugh in Theater, a live-watch comedy movie podcast hosted by Andy Atherton, the brother-sister rewatch podcast where siblings Kevin and Mary are reliving the classic sitcom The Office episode by episode. Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah, I knew you would get jealous at that one and start thinking of sitcoms that we can rewatch episode by episode. There's also The Great Debate, a podcast where Andy Atherton leads a panel through a series of arguments and topics far and wide. This week they did toppings on hot dogs being sauerkraut or relish, which if you bring it to someone in Chicago, there'd be...
What's the argument?
Like, which one would you prefer? But obviously some people would argue that that's only scratching the surface, but it's a good podcast nonetheless. The Glenn Butler podcast, Spectacular, brings you deep thoughts from the minds of Glenn Butler and his family and friends. We met Glenn Butler at the SummerSlam 2016. He was at the German Beer Hall.
Very nice. We have This Week in the NFL. Cowboy and D'Amato take you through recaps and previews of each week of the NFL season.
We have the NBA team with Adam Murray and Andrew Reach covering the world of hoops from coast to coast.
And The Year in Pop. A deep dive into pop culture year by year, hosted by Andy Atherton, Scott Carusculo, Dr. G, and D'Amato.
And then heading over to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed includes the Place to Be podcast, The Mothership, where it all started, with JT Rosero and Scott Carusculo, taking you chronologically through the history of the WWE, the Place to Be main event with Scott Carusculo, Nate Milton, and Steve Willey, breaking down all of the current events in the world of wrestling.
Wrestling Warzone, a podcast retrospective reliving the iconic Monday Night Wars, brought to you by Jay-Z and Chad Campbell.
And that's where they look at Raw and Nitro from the same night and sort of break it down and say which one was better that night. And the early ones, it's pretty much all Nitro being better because they were actually taking it to Raw and Vince McMahon didn't know what was going on at first. And then Row One, Seat One is a look inside the world of small town wrestling and beyond with host Ben Zanny welcoming a variety of guests each week.
Talking WCW heads to Center Stage Theater, where Tim Capel, Greg Phillips, and Jennifer Smith pay tribute to the legendary promotion from the Dirty South.
They're looking at certain WCW wrestlers, each one picks a match and goes over it and picks which one they think was the best. The Extreme Three-Way Dance takes you back on a trek through the land of extreme with JT Rosero, John D'Amato, and Jennifer Smith. So it's looking at ECW and its history.
Body Press Your Luck, a brand new wrestling podcast show hosted by JT Rosero and Jordan Duncan.
Yes, so that's coming up soon. It's not yet on there, but I think one of us will be on there pretty soon.
One of us. I wonder which one.
Who knows? And don't forget to check out placetobenation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes bringing you articles on topics in the world of wrestling, sports, and pop culture.
Check out a brand new podcast feed brought to you by our very own Jennifer Smith. The Jenny Position can be found on Podbean, iTunes, and your favorite podcatcher app. It will be the new home to Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out Drive-In, and lots of fun new content.
And if you're doing any of your online shopping this Christmas holiday season, make sure at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage, or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon and helps you out at PTBN with no cost to you, just a little kickback to the site to help pay all the bills of the very high salary members.
Rollers.
I mean, that's why we're doing it.
Right.
Check out our social media page and message boards at www.bigelow34proboards.com for information on joining GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in the conversation today and start researching your list. And Cindy, let's get to our list. So The Rock beat Mankind. So Mankind was fired. So then The Rock held a strike with all the wrestlers.
Yeah. Once again, petty.
Yes, but...
But that was part of the story.
That was the storyline, right. Yeah. So they rehired Mankind, and he was able to get a title match against Triple H. But at this Raw 8-man tag match, Triple H gave Mankind a pedigree through the table, rolled him in the ring, and only got a 2 count off of that, but then hit the pedigree again and got the win. But then afterwards, he kept beating up Mankind, and then Mankind fought back threw him out of the ring, hit his diving elbow off the ring apron, which he always did as Cactus Jack, and then ripped the mask off and did the bang bang, which was a Cactus Jack thing. And that was in St. Louis.
Okay.
So then the next night, January 11th, as you know, is my...
Your birthday. Yes.
So my 14th birthday, my dad bought me and my cousin tickets to Smack... Me, my cousin, and himself tickets
to Smack... Oh, your dad went?
My dad went and was around. Huh?
You and Matt went?
Yes. Yeah, and my dad, who was just sitting there the whole time, had no idea what was going on, didn't care.
That's love.
As we were driving there, he's like,
"That's love.
Is Hulk Hogan or Randy Savage going to be there?" Aww. We're like, "No, they're in WCW." He's like, "Oh, okay. So I won't know anyone?" We're like, "Not really."
He's
like,
"Were they serving beer at least for him?"
Yeah, I think he had a couple of
Miller Lights.
But yeah, aww. I mean, it was a Tuesday night. He's not going to, and he's driving a couple of 14-year-olds. He's not going to get wrecked. But so, anyways, so the show starts, and Triple H comes out, and he had a phony Mankind with him. Who was like, "Oh, you're the best. I can't fight you at the Royal Rumble." So then Mankind came out in his mask and like the blood tattered shirt that he had from Monday.
The match before. Okay.
And he says, like, "Mankind is a good man, but the one thing he is not is he's not ready to face you at the Royal Rumble." So then already everyone kind of knew what was coming. And then he rips off the mask, rips open his button shirt and reveals the Cactus Jack shirt and says, "I know a guy who can fight you. See you," and it's Cactus Jack. So then he runs out, beats up Triple H, and destroys the fake Mankind. And then, and they do it really well because, for one thing, Cactus Jack's first match in the WWE was in Madison Square Garden.
Oh, okay. Well, sorry, so that's back up. So what was 14-year-old Ryan's reaction?
Oh, I was going crazy. I was wearing my Cactus Jack shirt.
Oh, perfect.
Which was always what I wore to events. And that was like...
I've seen pictures of that.
I had known that this was... I kind of... felt this was going to happen because you knew Mick Foley was winding it down, so you knew that he was going to go back to Cactus Jack. Like, Mankind was great, but his best character was Cactus Jack.
I would agree with
that. And the thing that was like always his, like, his claim to fame,
Cactus Jack.
Yeah, I mean, that's how he wrestled for 15 years and 11 of them were as Cactus Jack.
Yeah, that so. Makes sense. Yeah, Dude Love, was that the end?
That was like 98, 99.
Okay.
Like, that was kind of always
a feel-good character.
Like I'm going to be able to take it easy tonight.
Depending on the zeitgeist, yeah. Yes. I don't feel like wrestling, so yeah, I'm going to
have matches with Owen Hart where we hit each other with popcorn. Because that's what they did.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that one.
No, that was those are house show matches, unfortunately.
We're not going to watch those?
Well, I don't have access to them. Maybe they'll show up as hidden gems on the network, and we'll be able to fit them in. But, and the stage was, and, like, it even started in 97. So this feud had been going on for a while, but Triple H, Mick Foley was always a feud, basically.
Okay.
So in 97, it was kind of the same setup. It was supposed to be Dude Love versus Triple H.
Dude Love?
Dude Love versus Triple H and Madison Square Garden on Raw in a Falls Count Anywhere match. And before the match, Dude Love is on the Titantron and he interviews Mankind.
I've seen that clip before.
And then Cactus Jack comes out and that's Cactus Jack's debut in the WWF.
Okay, in the WWF.
So, and then...
Wait, did he fight WCW before?
He fought in WCW, ECW, and like Japan. Like, he had fought everywhere he had wrestled before, he was always just Cactus Jack.
Okay.
So that's why Triple H gets so much credit for in 2000. Like, all he does is take off a mask and rip off his shirt. And Triple H could have just been like, "I don't care." But no, he sells it like the devil is coming to fight him. And so that's what made it, like, so believable and ratcheted up everything. So then they get the actual match.
Bar. Yeah. Okay.
So the actual match, it is, I think, the best brawl the WWF has ever done.
Well, I don't have as much context as you, but I did think it was very good. It was definitely the most gratuitous, kind of very attitude era.
Yes.
A lot going on. Yeah, we can definitely talk about everything with, like, the barbed wire and the thumbtacks. And that was, like, before I realized what kayfabe was, and I'd see the commercials for it. And I'd be like, "Oh, my gosh."
Yeah,
so, I was very naive about the inner workings of wrestling.
So they brawl into the crowd right away.
Oh, that's right.
And then they brawl out to the entranceway, which was that great... street entrance.
Streetscape, yeah.
And the one thing that You don't really notice it if you're watching it just the first time, but he suplexes him onto the pallet, and it punctures his leg. And it didn't have it on the network version, but the home video version shows him getting stitched up afterwards. Oh, really? He needed more stitches in his leg than he needed on his head because it was so deep in his leg. It was like, they said it was like a half inch into his calf muscle.
Yeah.
And it's a 26-minute match, and that probably happens like 8 minutes, maybe. And
not even.
So then they fight back to the ring. Triple H kicks Jack, throws him in, goes under the ring, and pulls out the barbed wire 2x4, that was the first time in the WWF they ever had that.
And let's talk about that, because was that really barbed wire? Because it looked suspect in the days of HDTV.
Yes. So when Cactus Jack brings it in and the ref tries to stop him, and Triple H hits a low blow and gets it. He hits Foley twice in the gut with it. That's barbed wire. Then, because you could even tell, as he's hitting him, he's, having to rip it away from his shirt.
Yeah.
But, back in that time, Mick Foley would wear, the double arm singlet over, and then his shirt over it. So it probably wasn't hitting his actual skin, probably.
Right.
Or if it was, it was one or two barbs hitting him. So then Cactus Jack, I think, hits a leg drop or something. He gets control, but then the ref takes the barbed wire 2x4, puts it under the Spanish announce team.
That's right, yeah.
And then immediately Cactus Jack gains control, and the referee stooges out the Spanish announce team. I don't have it. They took it.
Okay.
And he goes over there. And he hits the one guy.
Right.
And then the other guy magically brings it out, even though it was given to the other guy on his side.
Yeah, I didn't notice
so
that. Watched it again and probably catch up on things.
And in his book, Mick Foley talks about the next one, it was still barbed wire, but it was all filed down.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Because then what they do is, that's when he hits Triple H with it three times.
Right.
And then is raking his face out. So it was just metal points, but it wasn't it was curved and barbed to cut.
Jacks or something.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't, it was just, I mean, Triple H definitely bladed himself, and then
it didn't do any actual harm.
Right. It just was there for the effect.
It was a good effect. I mean, people were losing their minds, and I didn't know, see, once again, not having the context, I didn't realize this was the first time that the barbed wire 2x4 was used.
Yeah, this was the first time, and it was, they had always kind of brought it up because they had shown video packages always for Mick Foley, Cactus Jack, especially, I think, going into this match the week before on Raw, they had gotten the footage of these Japanese death matches he competed in, where it was the ropes were barbed wire, there were explosives in the ring.
What? That sounds like a video game.
Yeah, exactly. That's how Japan was, though, back in the mid-90s. It was a little tiny Japan federation that he wrestled in. So they were we can't compete with the two big companies. We'll just have people blow each other up. And just
go for over-the-top ridiculous.
It was a King of the Deathmatch tournament, and one of them was a barbed wire bed match. The next one was, one of the matches was a plate, a bed of plate glass.
Oh.
Like a light tube match.
Wow.
All these crazy matches. And then the last one, he fought Terry Funkin, was literally an exploding ring match, where at 9 minutes, parts of the ring exploded. And so he fought Terry Funk won.
Wacky racist.
Yeah. And in his book, he talks about how he went to his boss afterwards, this Japanese billionaire. And he was big show, Mr. Yokohama-san or whatever. And he's bonus. And the guy gave him gave him a yen and bought a Pepsi out of the vending machine, gave it to him and said, "That your bonus, Cactus-san."
Wow.
And he's three shirts in because he's covered in blood so much.
Wow, yeah.
And that was when he kind of realized, I should probably figure out a way to get into the WWF and make money.
I was actually thinking, he must have really been hard up if he was subjecting himself to that in Japan.
Well, because he was always told the WWF wouldn't want him because he didn't look the part.
Right, yeah.
And he ended up being probably the fourth biggest star of their biggest their hottest period of all time. So
yeah, I think he turned out okay. I started to read that book.
Yeah, there's parts of it that I could see.
As the layperson, maybe not be into as much. Yeah. We did. I did see his stand up with you though.
Yes, in South Bend, Indiana. Yes, right across the street from the prison.
Yep.
The dude drop in.
He was good. No, I think he's really done a good job of reinventing himself.
Yeah, he has
done a lot of different careers.
And I mean, he's a guy who, like, he retired at 35 because he did it because he knew, like, there were times he said where he forgot how to get home from the airport.
He knew
his head was going, and he was able to kind of reinvent himself. Even his last year of his career, he was basically like just a comedy character, and then he had these last two matches where he let it all out.
Right.
And so the match ends where he gets out. Well, first, Jerry Lawler says, Mick Foley pulls out a bag, which he had used early. This had been used before in WWF.
Oh, really? The thumbtacks?
The thumbtacks. And Jerry Lawler says, it's a sandbag.
Yeah, he's not smart.
And even Jim Ross is like, I'm like a sandbag, King. Of course, it's the thumbtacks. And he tries to throw Triple H into it, but of course, for Mick Foley, whenever he brings out the thumbtacks, he gets thrown into it.
Yeah,
and then he gets pedigree. Or first he gets the pedigree.
Right.
And he kicks out of the pedigree, and no one. This Steve Austin, The Rock, Mankind himself, they had all been beaten by... The pedigree itself was like a death move. Like, you didn't kick out of it. So he kicks out of the pedigree.
Because he couldn't, or because...
Because it was just that. It was... Because this was still... Triple H wasn't, you know, head of the company yet. I mean, he wasn't even close to that. He was like the guy they were trying to make the top heel.
I gotcha. Yeah.
Because this was at a time... Steve Austin was out injured. The Rock was the top face, and he's in the Rumble match later that night. And okay. He comes out during this match to help.
Oh, that's right. Mankind, yeah.
Or help Cactus Jack. But their top heel, like, because Vince McMahon really was the top heel the year before, and he just would have guys fight for him. Like, he had The Rock fight for him, but he was really the top bad guy. So this was really, they were trying to make Triple H the top heel, and this was really the match that put him over the top.
Yeah,
where it wasn't, because like beforehand there was like, oh, he could wrestle good in technical matches, but could he brawl? And
no, he holds his brawl. Own and yeah.
hits the and pedigree into the tacks. What did you think about that?
It looked very painful.
Yes, even the ref, I think, at one point is counting and gets tacks in his hand.
Oh,
and
yeah,
you see him like the last three count, he kind of shakes his hand.
Thank you. And this one, Triple H was the one that bled.
Yes, he bleeds.
And that happened
relatively
early in the match.
Yeah, he gets.
And so he definitely got the most amount of blood over his face by virtue of doing it so soon. I think it was definitely. I don't know if he was smearing it intentionally, but he kind of had the
I remember reading back then that he had definitely been chewing your Tylenol, which is what you call it, because if you wanted to bleed a lot, you would chew Tylenol before the match because
it's your blood.
It makes it look worse than it actually is.
It's like when you get head injuries when you've been drinking.
Yes, I don't know. I have no personal memory of this.
That's true.
Obviously, I have no memory. But, so, moving on.
No, really good match. I think I'm going to put this in my, you know, near the top of my watch for the week for sure.
So, did you have your second Madison Square Garden?
Oh, I just...
Fun fact, or was that the Boston?
The Boston Garden? Madison okay. Square Gardens.
Right. All right.
That's what I got.
So, moving on, we stay with the Royal Rumble.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to the 2007 Royal Rumble, January 28th. John Cena defending his title in a last man standing match against Umaga.
Yeah, I definitely never seen anything with Umaga.
Okay, well, Umaga is part of the legendary Samoan family in wrestling.
So just one really big Samoan family in wrestling?
The most part, it's also, you have to think about the fact that, for one thing, any Samoan could claim relationship to The Rock, basically, because his grandfather was technically a high chief of the tribe.
Okay.
Which means you are part of his family.
Okay.
Technically.
I gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
But the wrestling Samoan family isn't actually related to him. Like,
okay.
Him and The Rock claim they're cousins. but they're not
you
really
can say
blood
that with
cousins.
Anybody.
Right, but yeah. Like, so I'm going to look at the NOI family, which is what
they
are. So
oh my God, that family tree is
huge. Yeah, look at this family tree. It is extensive.
Yeah. And they're all wrestlers?
Most of them are wrestlers.
Is Manti Te'o on there too?
No, his girlfriend is, but he didn't make it.
Okay.
So.
Oh, Naomi's on there. Oh, because she's married to the Uso. Yeah.
So Umaga is. So his mom is Sika and Afa. They are brothers, the Wild Samoans. You've seen their figures at Target before, I believe.
I have? Okay.
Yeah, they were like the Wild Samoans in the night.
How many kids, sorry to interrupt, how many kids does this couple have? One, two, three, four, five, six.
Yeah, well, you're on Samoa. What else are you going to do?
I guess.
And then you see how it's really blood brother.
Okay.
Peter Maivia. The Rock's grandpa.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that's how everyone else kind of just runs down from there. So, yeah. So, Sika and Afa, they were the Wild Samoans in the WWF in the 1970s and 80s. And they basically had all these, like, Yokozuna.
Yep. Heard of him.
Okay. Rosie, he was a guy. He's Roman Reigns' brother.
Oh, okay.
And then...
He has Roman Reigns on this family?
Yeah,
too?
There he is. Joe Inouye.
What's his first name?
Leate. Joseph. He goes by Joe. It's a little easier.
Yeah. So they have a Samoan name and they have an American name.
I think
name
so. Yeah, that's kind
type
of...
Type thing.
They
oh,
have,
wow.
Their Samoan name, then their middle name is kind of Americanized to gotcha. Make it easier for them.
So we can't butcher their... We don't
well, although...
Their names.
Umaga was Edward Fatu. So that's pretty easy. And then... So his brother was Rikishi,
who is
the Usos' dad.
Right.
And the guy with the stink face where he'd stick his ass in people's faces.
Yeah, that's also not sanitary.
No. So yeah, even here's Trinity. She's on
I saw that.
Naomi is on the
yeah,
the
I haven't watched Total Divas in a while.
Family tree. So Umaga, so he showed up in like 2002 teaming with Rosie, and they were called 3-Minute Warning. They were a tag team. And then eventually that broke up and Umaga came back as Umaga, like, playing the Samoan Savage character.
Right.
That he had.
So he's really leaning into the stereotype.
Yeah, well, originally, supposedly at the time, the WWF made a play for Samoa Joe.
Really?
But they told him it was going to be, you'd have to play, like, this character.
Oh.
And he turned it down. So then they were like, well, we have this guy who's bigger than Samoa Joe and just as athletic, and we're just going
to
make him
a
main event. Yeah, and willing to paint tattoos all over his face and not speak English at all. So they brought him in, and in the video package, I don't know if you noticed, like the month before he fought John Cena at the pay-per-view, and he loses like via fluke roll-up.
Oh, that's right.
And that was his first loss ever.
Yeah,
so
they made a big deal out of it.
Then they made a big deal out of it, and they decided, because authority figures always hate John Cena, because he keeps it real, I guess.
Oh.
Well,
I feel like John Cena kind of is an authority figure.
He is now, yeah. He is.
Yeah.
He's basically become an authority figure.
You're right. Back then, 2007, he was still really playing into like the Army.
Right, yeah.
And everything was very camo.
He was the Army, but he was also like... Again, he was a rebel also at the same time somehow. But anyway, so they let Umaga's manager, Armando Alejandro Estrada, choose the stipulation, and he chose a last man standing match, so it would be very definitive. It wouldn't be like a fluke.
Good, the roll up. Okay. I see there's some good tactic behind that good strategy.
Yeah, so it made sense at the time, and the week before Umaga hit a flying splash through a table to John Cena. That's why he had the tape around his ribs.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they made a big deal about that.
Yes. So the match itself, what did you think?
I thought it was good. Let me look at my notes. The blood, this, once again, not a lot of blood.
Yeah,
this
John Cena, he tries to lift up Umaga for the FU and falls and hits his face on the stairs.
That's right. That's how he bled.
And John Cena is a great bleeder because, like, when he's bleeding and like he'll always be able to like force it out and like makes the faces where it
like squirts
it like squirts out almost.
That's gross.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have Last Man Standing, I think, there's not as much drama because, like, the whole point of the pinfalls is, you know, yeah, the kickouts and the
so-closes. I kind of felt that during this match as well.
Really?
Like, it was originally going in, if I just did the rankings without watching it again, I would have had this. Like I said, the Royal Rumble's 10 out of 10 for me. The Triple H Cactus Jack, 10 out of 10, top 5. I would have thought this is 10 out of 10, top 10.
Mm.
Seeing it again, it's not far off. It's like 9.8 probably.
It was still good.
It's still really good, and it's probably still in my top 20. But like when I had first heard of this, that they were doing this contest, I wrote down what I thought would be my top 10, and this was in there.
Oh, really?
And this was not.
So this is getting kicked out of the top 10.
It's just kicked out. It's still a great
match.
Top
20, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, saying it's like we said.
Well, it's a good thing we're doing this.
Yes, reassess. This is helping me reassess my choices.
Yeah. Good. No, yeah. So I said it was Umaga really dominated at the beginning.
Yeah.
It was a lot of like variety. There was like the steps and they had the table and they
John Cena
had the ring rope
holding up the steps like they weighed 300 pounds.
Right,
and
yeah.
Luckily they didn't. Usually Michael Cole always points out that the ring steps are like 400 pounds. Michael Cole doesn't know what weight is.
Exactly.
I think he, I don't know if he grew up on Mars or something or wherever things weigh a lot more. I don't know which planet that would be, but
I think the bigger planets have more gravity.
Okay, yeah. So I don't know. Maybe he was raised on Jupiter where the most egregious ever was there's buried alive matches and there's a headstone at the top. And he would always say that those weighed over 10,000 pounds.
Well, that's not right.
No.
That's very wrong.
Yes.
Even the average wrestling fan, I think, could understand that one. No offense.
Well, I don't know. Some people, there's a lot of...
I don't know, unless you have no concept of
weight.
I don't know.
But I would hope most people do.
Within a certain limit. But over, I think, well, like, could you tell the difference between 500 pounds and 600 pounds?
No, but you once know, you're like at that weight, it's kind of like...
Yeah, and I guess the tombstone probably didn't look like it weighed.
And, like, the ring steps were always a thing where, like, John Cena always... would do that. He'd always struggle to pick them up. Then there's other times you see a guy just pick it up and run it. And you could tell it's like, oh, it's 30,
it's like the
maybe
like
45 pounds.
It's with the same materials like the aluminum chairs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably even less than that. And it's just kind of ridiculous to always be claiming. Like, for John Cena to struggle to pick up something, and seeing it as how I've seen him pick up Edge and The Big Show at the same time, and they're
that's a lot of weight.
750 pounds.
Well, those steps
seeing him struggle
pounds.
To pick up a pair of ring
those
steps,
Michael Cole steps,
kind of kills the illusion. But I mean,
gotcha.
I get. But when he does it, it's a big thing. Like he picked them up and threw them at Umaga, and this thing. Whenever he does pick up the steps, he makes it count. It's usually
that's
him
true.
Throwing it at someone.
That's true.
In the aisleway, at least. And then this is one of my all-time favorite spots in wrestling. Can you guess what it is in this match?
Oh, gosh. My notes aren't that detailed.
Okay. When Umaga lays him out on the one table.
Okay.
Then
yeah.
he goes
oh,
down the table.
Yeah, we talked about this.
Ripping off the covers of each table, ripping off the TVs off of each table, goes to the third table, runs across all three tables.
That's right.
And tries a diving splash and misses. But gets up at 9 to continue the match.
That's right.
I just, every time I see it, I burst out laughing.
Why?
It's just such a ridiculous thing. Like, for one thing, okay, I get that a splash would hurt through a table. Why does he have to run 20 feet?
Get that running start.
I guess so. It's just, it's hilarious. And he's like yelling the whole time. And anytime a guy yells and I guess a foreign line. It's probably not even actual Samoan that he's yelling in.
Yeah,
it's probably just
gibberish.
And then the match ends with John Cena committing homicide.
That's right. Yeah.
He chokes him out, and then Umaga starts to come to at 7. So then he chokes him out more to the point where
that's
Umaga
right.
is dead.
Yes, yes, yes. So, yeah, this one was just okay.
Okay,
it was a lot. I mean, I know it had your.
I see how the Last Man Standing match could.
Yeah,
it is a hard, and I would say this is the best Last Man Standing match.
Oh, okay.
That I've ever seen, and it does sometimes hurt the momentum of the
match.
Yeah,
exactly.
And it's not like because it's not a 10 count. It's like a 45-second to a minute
count
almost the way they stretch it out.
Right.
Which, yeah, that I kind of like the old Texas death matches where you'd have to get a pinfall and then they would count to 10.
Okay.
I think that would have been maybe a better thing.
Even like count to 5.
Especially this, because where was this event?
Oh, this is the AT&T Stadium in San Antonio?
Yes.
Not a lot of fun facts about it. Yeah, well, it's not a very fun place.
Fun area. The fun fact I have about it.
Oh, yeah. What is it?
Is, so we went to the 2017 Royal Rumble, and that was held in the Alamo Dome. And NXT the night before was held in the Freeman Coliseum. So NXT was in the 8,000 seat arena. The Rumble was in the 70,000 seat arena, and they eschewed the 20,000 seat arena for that weekend, which is kind of interesting, I think.
Yeah, well, the AT&T, sorry, the Alamo Dome, no, the AT&T Stadium was for the Spurs. The Alamo Dome was supposed to be the all-purpose one.
So and the Spurs, I think they started playing at the Alamo Dome.
They did, and they were dominating the schedule, so they said they wanted their own place. So they're only there for 7 years.
Okay.
Yeah, the Alamo Dome was 1993. How many, like, Alamo, like, there was, like, the King Dome, the Sky Dome, how many, like...
The Astrodome.
Astrodome. How many domes are left with that, like, a name like that?
With that name?
You see what I'm asking, right?
I think... Well, the Alamo Dome's still there.
The Alamo Dome. What was the one in...
The Silver Dome is gone. The Superdome is still there in New Orleans.
That's true. What about the... What was the one in Minneapolis?
Oh, the Hubert H. Humphrey... The Humphrey Dome? That's gone, because the one time the roof...
Fell in,
and they kind of...
It's called the Humphrey Dome?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound right.
Well, because it was named after the governor of Minnesota at the time.
Hmm.
And, well, now it's... They have a dome there now, but I think it's called, like, Bank of America Stadium or whatever. So it's not a dome. It's that dome in the name, which is what you're asking for, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Tokyo Dome in Japan, which is where New Japan, the big wrestling company in Japan, always has their big show in January.
Was ever a Chicago Dome?
No. Well, that was a big thing in 2001, 2002 when they were redoing Soldier Field.
They should have made that a dome.
That was a big thing that they could have made it a dome for like $400,000 more, which...
Oh, that's... I don't think... That little money...
sounds a lot, but it's not that much when they put in like $1 billion to renovate the stadium.
I think $400,000 is a low estimate to make it a dome.
Yeah, well, I think...
It's like an extra $4
million. Yeah. Exactly. Well, no, I meant $4 million.
Okay,
yeah,
I was going to say $400,000. Yeah. No.
But I mean, it wouldn't have been to the amount that people got taxed anyways. It would have been like a drop in the bucket. And right now, Soldier Field is the lowest NFL seating capacity, so we'll never get a Super Bowl, never get a WrestleMania, which is a big thing.
They've done them in Chicagoland before, so you know.
Yeah,
that's true.
It was a big mess, and it was all because they wanted to save the stupid columns in front, and
they had to unlandmark that to do those renovations.
Yeah, and it looks horrible. It's this mistake by the lake. It's
that's Cleveland.
Well, it's also Soldier Field. It looks like a spaceship.
Yep.
It's very stupid.
Yeah.
All right, moving on from Umaga John Cena, as we obviously were talking about right now.
Yeah, it didn't hold our attention for very long.
Right. We go to April 29th, 2012, in the Allstate Arena,
we were
talking about, Chicago, Illinois.
Close to our abode. Yes. Not really that close, but
closer than any of the others.
Yeah.
Brock Lesnar versus John Cena in an Extreme Rules match. This was Brock Lesnar's first match in 8 years in the WWF.
Yeah, they really hyped it up.
I had tickets to this event, actually, and because I went to the Raw in December. And they went on sale the next day. I immediately went online, bought tickets, and then 2 weeks before the show, sold each ticket for $100 ticket per ticket, $100 profit per ticket.
Oh, yeah.
So that was and I was more than happy to just stream it on my computer at home and watch the event, because it really is one of their better secondary pay-per-views.
Right. No, yeah, that's a good little flip there of those tickets.
So Allstate Arena, do you want to... Let's start there with your fun fact.
Yeah, well, once again, not a lot of fun facts, but I did like to mention that that is the site of the infamous Creed concert in December of 2002, where Scott Stapp had an unfortunate combination of alcohol and pills that caused him just to roll on the stage.
And being a bad singer.
And just being, a horrible singer.
Yeah.
But yeah, my best friend Michelle was at the concert.
Of course she was.
We were roommates at the time in college.
She was big in her. late 90s,
yeah, emo. But yeah, she came back to school in the winter, and she's like, oh yeah, I went to the Creed concert, and Scott's cap was just like rolling around on the stage. Yes. We all got a refund.
Yeah, well, at least you got a refund.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I still have to fact check that.
I hope she went to like a September 2003 Raw for it.
I highly doubt
that. Yeah, probably not.
She should have. I'm sure she would have wanted to get like Good Charlotte tickets or something. But
so yeah, and that, my two fun facts for the Allstate Arena. Well, for one, the first after they rebranded as the Allstate Arena, that was in June of 1999. First event there was Monday Night Raw, August 9th, 1999. And on that Raw, a very historical moment, Chris Jericho debuted. And that was, like, debuted in the WWE.
Oh, okay.
Like, they had this clock that was running down for, like, over a month.
For Chris Jericho?
It said Countdown to the Millennium.
Oh.
And then, during the middle of Raw, the Rock's in the ring cutting a promo. The clock goes back on the Titantron, cuts to 000. It goes black out. Then on the screen, it just says Jericho, and he pops up, and like he was a mid-card guy in WCW. He got one of the biggest pops of all time.
Why?
At this show. Just because people knew he was coming to the WWE.
Oh, okay.
And they had been like, I mean, if you just, that's the thing. If you hype something up so much, you can make people think it's a big idea. It's a big thing, even if it isn't.
Yeah, it's fake it till you make it.
Yep, and that's kind of what happened there, and it was a big, big, big deal. Like, he ended up kind of, like, he cut a promo against The Rock, but then The Rock cut it back on him and made him look like an idiot. And then eventually Chris Jericho kind of slid down into, like, the IC title picture for a while. But eventually he became, you know, one of the biggest guys.
And he's in the new one now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's the champion in AEW.
AEW, yeah. And yes. So he's been wrestling for 20 years.
Oh, he's been wrestling for like 30 years.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, and then my second fun fact, it's hosted through WrestleManias. Well, one third of WrestleMania 2. So WrestleMania 2 is in three different arenas.
That's right, yeah.
New York. Well, Uniondale, New York. So, Long Island. Chicago and LA. And then WrestleMania 13. And then WrestleMania 22. But WrestleMania 22 was the last WrestleMania held in just a mid-sized stadium.
Oh, before, like,
since
upgraded.
Then, it's been nothing but domes and football stadiums.
I was going to ask, like, would they ever do one, like, at the United Center in Chicago,
I think it's too small. It's only 20,000 people.
Oh, yeah, that is too small. I mean, yeah,
now it's, like, 70,000 or more.
That's crazy.
For the most part. I mean, really, everything since then has been at least that.
That's true. Yeah, it's been in the big stadiums.
Yeah, that's why I keep waiting for Minneapolis is always rumored to be getting one, but then they, for some reason or another, don't get it. That's probably the next. I guess Ford Field's still around, and that got WrestleMania 23, and that might be up again.
So there's still some possibilities for some good Midwest.
Yeah, I don't see Cleveland or...
No.
Well, St. Louis still has the Rams Dome.
What are they doing with that?
Well, Tommy's, your brother said that they still have like monster truck rallies and stuff.
Oh, that sounds about right.
I don't know if they packed 70,000 in.
I don't think
they
have.
I wouldn't be surprised in St. Louis if you get 70,000 people for a monster truck rally.
I don't
rally.
Know about that, but potentially.
So, but the match.
The match, yeah.
Yeah, so John Cena versus Brock Lesnar.
Two really big, beefy,
yes,
veiny, steroidy.
Only 16 minutes, this one also.
This went a lot faster.
This was a lot faster pace. And right away, this was another one where right away Brock Lesnar just tackles John Cena and just goes off on him with elbows.
That's right.
And John Cena is just insane because apparently he didn't want a blade. I think he just said.
Really gets like cut right away from his elbows.
Yeah, and it's like they slow it down and look at it a few times. And you could tell that Brock Lesnar just busted him hard
that
way.
That time he legitimately drew blood.
And that is insane. This was after Brock Lesnar was the UFC heavyweight champion. He was, like, almost legitimately the toughest person in the world. And John Cena was like, no, I need to bleed, so to make it,
do it. Yeah.
Important. So that happens right away.
Sacrifices for his craft.
The referee and the trainer come in and, like, wipe him off, but they keep going.
And they were wearing gloves. And
yeah, they were wearing gloves.
It was still a little much, but it was at least a little bit more controlled environment.
And so they brawl for a while, and the one thing I liked the most was at one point the ref gets knocked out, and they go back in the ring, and Brock Lesnar picks the referee up with one hand by the belt and just like throws him in the ring just to make sure that he's able to get his count, but it doesn't work. And
well, yeah, because he knocks out the ref, and the ref isn't there to count.
Well, exactly. That's usually what happens to heels. Their own hubris hurts them.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's called hubris.
Yeah, and then, of course, John Cena, he hadn't used a chain for like 6 years.
Oh, yeah,
he comes out with a big chain. Yeah. And, of course, at the end of the match, Brock Lesnar tries a ridiculous dive at him, and John Cena punches him with the chain.
That's right.
Busting Brock Lesnar open. And that is just a pretty clear blade. That's
right across his
hairline and stuff. And I guess at this point, they were just like, we're paying Brock Lesnar so much money, he could do what he wants. If he wants to bleed, that's fine.
Did he want to bleed?
I think he felt that it would make the match better.
It happened near the end. It was almost like an afterthought.
Yeah, but it was kind of like in Rocky IV, when Rocky makes Ivan Drago bleed, it shows that he's human.
Oh.
It shows that he could be defeated.
I gotcha. All right.
And that's kind of like, it shows a weakness in Brock Lesnar. And then right after that,
we're humanists, yeah.
The FU on the steps, and that's the 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. He also like wrapped John Cena's legs up in the chain.
Yeah, at one point he
hung
him off the ring post and had his legs wrapped around the chain and was just punching him.
That's kind
of
silly. Yeah,
it kind of. I think it was something that they probably talked about before the match, and it sounded good, but in practice it didn't work that well.
I'm still kind of not clear on how much they like rehearse these.
For the most, now it's kind of different because they they write everything out.
Yeah, like, I remember even when we watched that Macho Man documentary, they talked about how Macho Man would like plan it, like move for move, and that's
most of the time they don't do that. They didn't do that.
Yeah, that's still.
And nowadays, I think that's kind of the practice, though.
Okay.
Like maybe not move for move, but like big moves for big move.
Yeah.
Like, but no, like Ric Flair would wrestle a 60-minute match, and he would know the finish.
That's it.
And that's it. They would just.
That's like a good testament to your improv and like to how good of athletes they are and improvisers and.
But then also, like, if he was having a 60-minute match, the fans were fine with there being an 8-minute chin lock and stuff, and them just talking about what they wanted to do the next 8 minutes, and then.
Yeah, there's pros and cons.
Yeah.
I think it's probably good to like know your big.
The big things.
Big hits.
Yeah, I think that works more. So. And then after the match, John Cena has this weird promo.
Oh, that's right.
Where he's talking about how he's going to be going away for a while and how this is going to upset a lot of people. People were like, is he talking about bleeding? Is he talking about how he's just cutting this weird promo after the match? Because he talks about how much he loves Chicago because they're chanting Cena sucks the whole time. But it didn't mean anything because he's just on Raw the next night. Like, nothing happened. So
what was the point of it?
No one really ever figured that out, I think. It's very odd, like, how that happened. But just thought I should mention it. And this...
maybe someone knows. I'm sure someone in the Place to Be Nation
could figure it out. Know what happened. This is another top-tier match. I'd say top 25, probably.
I could 9.8,
see
that.
Maybe out of 10.
They were evenly matched, like, in terms of size. Like, obviously Brock Lesnar came out first, but it wasn't, like, a dominating
Right. He dominates match. The start, but then John Cena makes you think he can't actually fight back and win.
Right, yeah.
All right, so looking at all five matches tonight, how would you rank them?
Okay, I think the lowest I would put, Iron Sheik versus Slaughter.
No, that's all right.
Next lowest... Probably the John Cena Umaga match. Well, it's just there was a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, no, there were.
Because I think that the Brock Lesnar Cena was better than that, so I want to put that ahead of the other John Cena. Number one, well, then number two, because I want my number one to be the Triple H Mick Foley.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
So number two, I'm going to put the Bruno Sammartino.
Okay.
Just because I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
I know that's not a very advanced or like.
No, sometimes,
nuanced opinion, but I was entertained.
And sometimes a good 8-minute match is better than a 16-minute great match.
Like, slower,
Sometimes I agree.
Yep.
Well, I don't agree, but I agree. I see what you
mean. My logic. Yes. Yeah. So yeah. I think number one, definitely the Royal Rumble.
Yeah.
In 2000. And I think that kind of just sums up with the blood, and you wanted something really gratuitous, like Attitude Era-y.
Yeah.
Like that kind of is like the quintessential, I think, kind of bleeding match.
Yeah. So for me, like I said, the first two matches, they're probably about the same for me, the boot camp match and the cage match.
Yeah, and I think
match.
It's different for you because you have a lot more context. experience and context.
And like, I probably do like the Bruno Piper match more than the boot camp match. But I have to think about the boot camp match, like, it has more historical significance, like I was saying. But then, going into the last three matches.
The actual match itself, though.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And I guess it's up to you on what your criteria is, if you're looking at in the context of the whole narrative or just, like, the match.
Right.
Itself.
By match itself, yeah. Right. And that's kind of, like, that's how the rankings are going to be interesting, how people vote, like. Are you just going to go by the match itself, or are you going to bring the whole storyline, bring the importance of the match? And we'll get into that with some of our next matches as well. So then looking at the last three matches, I would have, I think out of those three, I think I'd go number three, Brock versus John Cena.
Okay.
And then the last man standing match, although it's close. Like, I don't know. I might actually change because, like, I think the Cena-Brock match has a better flow. Like, because it's quicker it doesn't have the big time stoppages. Whereas the Umaga-John Cena match, I get it why they're doing it because of the last man standing step, but it kind of breaks things up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and like I said, there's no doubt in my mind the best match we've seen was Triple H versus Cactus Jack. It's top five, maybe top three.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's not going higher than that, but that's pretty high.
You're trying to challenge your assumptions with this, so it might...
Yeah, well, I know what my number one match is. Okay. It's been number one for 25 years. Okay. It's not going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, I have a guess on who it involves then.
So, real quick, next week, what we are going to do...
What are you doing?
All right, so next week, well, I kind of planned this out for our next 2 weeks.
Okay.
My idea is... Well, what's the Showcase of the Immortals?
You're asking me what the Showcase of the
Immortals? The Showcase of the Immortals, the biggest show they have all year.
WrestleMania?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So...
You phrased that. It's kind of funny.
Sorry. So, WrestleMania, and any match at WrestleMania is always going to have, like, you could almost add half a point to it right away because of the significance
of it. Right, it's going to have a higher standard.
Yeah, like, even if you have the main event of WrestleMania, and 6 months before it was the main event and a house show at Madison Square Garden, the match at WrestleMania is going to be, at the very least, more remembered and probably thought of in a higher light.
Yeah.
So, what we're going to do is we're going to do before and after WrestleMania.
Okay.
So, next week we'll watch matches that happened before WrestleMania. And then the next week, we'll watch those matches at WrestleMania.
Can you give me an example?
So, for example, like, we'll watch Bret Hart versus Steve Austin at Survivor Series 1996.
Okay.
And then they wrestle each other at WrestleMania 13 the following March. Yeah.
Oh, okay, I got you.
All the matches will have happened before.
Gotcha.
So next week we'll watch the matches that happened
during the lineups.
That is not WrestleMania.
The non-WrestleMania match.
And then the week after we'll watch the actual WrestleMania matches.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Okay. And then another idea later on, because there's also something in between that. But then we'll have WrestleMania Rewinds, where we'll watch a WrestleMania match, and then the follow-up.
Gotcha, yeah, the fallout.
Comes out later, rematches. So, yeah, I think that's a nice
little...
Because, the whole list, it's going to be a lot of WrestleMania matches. It's going to be a lot of SummerSlam matches. It's going to be a lot of the big-time matches, because that's the most known matches.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I think it's also good to look at the lesser
I think known so matches too.
And kind of try and think about where those match up.
No, I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
I like that concept.
Good. So you will take this ring?
Yes, I will take this ring.
Continue to go on?
Yes, I will continue on this journey with you.
All right, great. Well, we'll see you next time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop Feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.